Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Okay, something that I've been sharing and I'm so excited about is the manicora honey. Now, of course, everyone knows about the benefits of honey, but until you understand manicora's honey, it is worlds different. Not only is it thicker, it's creamier, it just tastes like heaven. Oh my goodness. But I swear it has helped to keep me from getting sick around my kids, or at least reduced how long that I'm sick and how long I'm out. Like, I have felt so much better since I've started introducing it, and I can even just use it as like a pre-workout. I just take a scoop and I have it, and it is so delicious. Now, let me tell you why it's different. It's ethically produced by manicora's master beekeepers in the remote forests of New Zealand. And every time I post about it, people from New Zealand are like, yep, that's ours. They're like so proud because it is so unique and it's so different. The bees gather the nectar from the manicora tea tree, which is packed with bioactives that give this honey 3 times more antioxidants and prebiotics than regular honey. You heard that right. 3 times. And these help to support your cells and your gut, where most of our immune system actually lives. So especially in the winter or busy travel schedules or just being inside a little bit more, this is going to give you that extra boost of nutrients throughout your day, especially if you just make it like a routine, whether it's before your workout or it's the first thing that you want to put into like your hot tea in the morning. Like, it is something that has become such a regular practice for Dom and I, and we do not regret it at all. It is truly a game changer, and all you need is 1 heaping teaspoon each morning to get the most out of those amazing bioactives. Now, it's easier than ever to try manicora honey. Just head to manicora.com/DocJen, and you get to save up to 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts with their starter kit, which comes with an MGO 850 plus manicora honey jar, 5 honey travel sticks, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. That's manicora.com/DocJen, and you get to save that 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts. And of course, we're going to have that linked up in the show notes below. I'm so excited to introduce to you Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Now, this is someone I've personally followed along with on social media, learned so much from, and I have been anticipating this interview for so long, especially just from what everyone's talking about right now. I need the myths. I need the facts. I need to get the evidence of what is real and what is not. And he is going to deliver it today. Now, Dr. Nadolski brings over a decade of expertise in obesity medicine with board certifications in obesity medicine and lipidology. Since becoming a doctor, he's helped thousands of patients lose weight and improve their quality of life through innovative healthcare delivery platforms. Dr. Spencer also has fun, educational, social media content where you can laugh and learn at the same time. Of course, we're going to have all of it linked up in the show notes, but I'm so excited for you to dive into this podcast with me. It's such a good listen. I hope you pass it along to other people who need to hear it as well. Dr. Spencer, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I have been anticipating this interview for quite a while. I think not only is it so hot of a topic on social media, but I think there's a lot to dissect and understand. And so I just really, truly appreciate not only your education that you do daily, but just your time being here with us today.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to come on, of course.
And when she says she's been anticipating this podcast, I have to say that you have been probably the most talked about person in our household other than our children.
Perfect.
Because of questions Jen has to ask you. So yeah, we're going to try to rapid fire and get through as much as we can. But let's start by asking, why obesity medicine? What led you to this path as you know, your career?
Yeah, as a former athlete, I'm a has-been now, washed up, but really interested in performance, got really into like nutrition and exercise science to be good at sports. And then when I went to med school, people thought, you're going to be a ortho doctor, sports med, meathead guy.
Ortho
and I was like, nah, I don't know. I shadowed the ortho guy. I was like, I don't really like this. I didn't really care about getting people to go from like a, 300 and some bench press to a 400 and some bench press, or a a 40-yard dash from a four or whatever to a lower four or whatever. So it was more so like the fulfillment of getting people to do go from nothing to something. And you see a huge increase in their quality of life and, you know, longevity, mortality differences, just doing something. So I was like, I really like this. It was just much more fulfilling. So I really got it. It was actually a newer field. The bariatric surgery has been around, and obesity medicine has been around, but all they would do is like give people amphetamine like medicines, which can actually work okay, but that's all they had back then. But right when I was getting to medical school is right when these medicines were coming out in 2007 is when the first like GLP-1 was coming out. It was only for type 2 diabetes, but this concept of more biological tools was coming out. So I don't know. It's just much more fulfilling is the gist than my former has been performance days.
Yeah. I mean, that reminds me, even as a physical therapist, when I would meet someone who was doing incredible, you know, working on being independent as a cerebral palsy patient versus someone who's like, I get knee pain after running 2 miles. And I'm like, well, which one is really, you know, as impactful here? Yeah. So totally understand that. Now, when it comes to weight loss in those who are obese or even just overweight, I think there's a lot of stigma and judgment around it, quite frankly. And so what do people typically get wrong when it comes to those who are trying and want to lose weight, but are really just not successful?
Yeah, I think blaming themselves, and this is where other people say, but they have to have some sort of responsibility. Yeah, nobody's going to be able to do it. Obviously, if I could do it for my patients, I would. I would take on that burden, but obviously I can't. So they're, yes, the person themselves have to do it, but when they blame themselves, it actually worsens. It sounds counterintuitive. People are like, no, we should shame them and say, that's your fault. Now you got to do something about it. But that it actually has the opposite effect. And I've had a lot of research doing this. So I think the biggest mistake is going, I'm a failure. It's me. And that doesn't mean you're not able to do something about it. Doesn't mean it's hopeless and it's futile, whatever. It means that like take the pressure off yourself. There are other forces at play, and then go towards and move towards those other tools that we have to fight back against those forces. So I think that's the biggest thing is, and that's what we've gotten wrong as a society. And other people point towards other countries where, well, there's cultural differences too of where you grow up, but at least here, from in terms of shaming and stigma, it worsens things. So that would be what I would say.
I think that's super important to point out because, like you said, I guess it doesn't even seem counterintuitive to me. I feel like understanding that the psychology and mental aspect of anything when it comes to health is so integrated into the success and the outcomes. But like you said, there's tons of research to back up now that when we shame people or when we say it's their fault that they're failing, it doesn't get better. So I think that's important. So how does somebody approach weight loss outside of medications? If we're going with lifestyle and behavior change, like how can somebody start to maybe approach it differently if they are trying to and have failed or have been on this long journey of weight loss?
Yeah, it's kind of reframing it. And instead of, you know, of course, if you go like, well, it's not my fault, so that I guess I can't do anything about it. No, you can do something about it. I would say like frame it as obesity being biological. Yes, it doesn't mean environmental differences don't matter either, because that's what people will say. Like, oh, you think our environment hasn't changed? Of course it's changed. Like, stop making, that's a call that was a false dichotomy, is it's only can be one or the other. There's multiple things at play. But understanding when you're trying to lose weight, multiple forces start fighting against you. And one of them is biological from your own body. And it comes in the form of increases in appetite. So when many people have lost 50, 100, maybe more pounds in multiple times. So when I've had however many patients throughout the years, and it's just a common pattern of, yep, lost 50 to 100 or so pounds five times in the past, three, five, six times in the past. And then they think they're a failure because of it. And I was like, no, your body was fighting against you. And of course, the environment is not helping at all either. So yeah. We need a biological tool to help you do those things that you were doing fine. You were doing them fine at one point, but at some point you fell off. And it's not from a lack of willpower or because you just didn't want it enough. It's literally your body overwhelmed you to where you just virtually couldn't do it anymore. Mm. So if they approach it like that, they then feel they have hope. And it sounds counterintuitive because it sounds like, well, forget it. I guess it's not possible. It's like, no, we understand what's causing it. So now we can start finding ways to fight back against those. So that's how I reframe. And it doesn't mean you always have to have a medicine. Everybody's like, you're just pushing medicine. You're a big pharma shill. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a big pharma shill. But there are people that are able to do it without the medicine. It really depends. And not everybody has as strong of biological pushes. And that's why you see somewhere around 10% of people can lose a substantial amount of weight without medicine. Whether they can do it over long periods of time remains to be seen. But mm-hmm. For the other people, they do well with the medicine because that strong driver of trying to regain the weight is there in the form of appetite. Again, there's other things involved, but it's a lot of it's appetite.
Right. And that continues to be the biggest struggle for people. So what is this medicine? What is a GLP-1? I think just at the base of it, right? What is this and how does it work on the body to actually help?
Yeah, I always bring people back to this idea. It's called an incretin. This is the incretin effect. They found it in the 60s. They injected glucose in the veins versus had people drink glucose. And it's because they were able to measure insulin now in the body. And so they wanted to see how much insulin was produced if you inject the glucose versus drinking it. So for anybody listening, when you ingest glucose or sugar gets into your blood, your pancreas then senses it and sends out this hormone called insulin. Insulin is the hormone that tells your cells to take in the sugar so it doesn't build up into your bloodstream. Well, they were surprised because I always tell the story because I'm like, I would think if you injected glucose, it would go straight to your pancreas and your pancreas would shuttle out a bunch of insulin and get it in faster. Well, they called it the incretin effect. There's something about the intestines. They found some secretion of hormone of some sort. Something was going on to where they ingested or drank sugar, made more insulin, a larger amount of insulin than if you injected it. Hmm. So they're like, what is going on here? And so they called it the incretin effect. And it wasn't till the 80s where they started finding these various incretins, one of them being GLP-1. And it took a long time. They were kind of looking into it. Could this be used as a drug for diabetes? Oh, yeah, interesting. Well, the problem is our own GLP-1, which stands for glucagon-like peptide 1, is broken down quick. Our own natural GLP-1, which is released from our intestines, broken down within a minute or two. So they're like, we can't just infuse people with GLP-1 all day, like with a saline drip with GLP-1 or the bag of it, connected to you all day. That wouldn't work out. Actually, there were some discoveries. They figured out the enzyme that breaks it down, and we have they're called DPP-4 inhibitors. DPP-4 is this enzyme that breaks it down. They did develop drugs into that, so we do have those. But really cool, interesting. Serendipitously, they found this lizard called the Gila monster out in the desert. Do you have Gila monsters where you guys are?
Never heard of that.
Where you guys are in California?
Yeah.
Well, in Vegas, actually, this is another really interesting thing. In Vegas, the one of the mascots for their hockey teams, the Gila monster. I was just there at a Vegas obesity conference and just so happened to go to a hockey game unrelated to the whole thing. And they're like shouting out the Gila monster. I was like, what? That's your mascot? Well, the Gila monster, it's venom. So this is where you'll see some of the myths. Like, you're injecting venom from a poisonous lizard. And you're going to kill people with this stuff. It's like, well, no, it's serendipitously that the lizard was going long periods of time without eating. So they thought maybe this thing has something to do with blood sugar. Well, come to find out, it wasn't related to that, but they found out the venom had a portion of it that was similar to our own GLP-1, our human GLP-1.
Wow.
But the cool thing was it didn't get broken down by our own enzyme. That was the first ever GLP-1 that came out. That was in whatever, 2006, right when I was getting in medical school, just 2007. That one was called Byetta or exenatide. Later on, they figured out how to then use human GLP-1 and modify it in a way to where our own enzymes didn't break it down. So that's where these medicines got stronger and better. And you're starting to see all sorts of crazy stuff because they're adding things to it and hitting different receptors. But the gist is that originally, yes, it was intended to help with type 2 diabetes, because in type 2 diabetes, our incretin effect is a little bit blunted, meaning it doesn't work as well. So then they were helping people improve their sugar control. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, people were losing weight and they're like, well, let's study at this at different doses. And then they figured out different doses. One of the earliest ones was called liraglutide. That was first used for type 2 diabetes, and they cranked up the dose. And in 2014, they got it approved for obesity or weight management. It was okay, about 7 or 8% total body weight loss, which in comparison, when you're looking at large populations, lifestyle, pretty decent lifestyle advice and coaching gets around 6 to 7% total body weight loss. So we're looking at 7 to 8% by itself with just light coaching. So it's like, it's okay, but it's not that much better than like pretty good lifestyle. It wasn't until these newer versions came out, semaglutide is what everybody knows as Ozempic, higher dose being Wegovy, which is for weight management. But that one is a once a weekly, and that's where they saw 15% total body weight loss. And so you go from lifestyle, you know, 6-7% over about a year to 15, because then the bigger jump then is with bariatric surgeries, around 25-30%. So now all of a sudden there's something that's kind of in between that's like really good, that's not surgery. And that's really how these things got popular. For type 2 diabetes first, yes. And then they're like, yes, this has an appetite effect. They studied it, modified it, kept going. And then really it's got big in the, you know, 2021 is when Wegovy, the higher dose version of semaglutide, which is the same as Ozempic, came out. And then viral on TikTok, I was part of it. I was like, man, my patient just lost 50 pounds, blah, 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 blah. And that was kind of the early days of talking about it. So that's yeah. kind of the quick history around it.
Amazing. Yeah.
And I think in that history, you even covered a couple of the next questions we wanted to ask. Because one of them was why now? Why is this all of a sudden becoming so popular? Because yeah. you even mentioned it was back in the 80s that we start to discover these things. And I think you covered that being that we started to learn these doses and these new forms yep. of medicine that got that 15-20%, you know, weight loss. And then the follow-up question was, you know, bariatric surgery has always kind of seemed to be an option for people who have struggled to lose weight. Do you see this becoming kind of that first step before people go to bariatric surgery? Or if somebody ends up continuing with bariatric surgery, can this be a first line to help them cut some weight before that procedure to help with complications?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the surgeons get mad about it, but I'd say 5 to 10 years, but we're going to see a point where it's bariatric surgery is relatively rare. And it's already happening. People wow. are opting for the medicines. They work, they have somewhat similar mechanisms, but the medicine has a stronger biological effect. The surgery, obviously, you know, smaller stomach, feel a little bit fuller, but it's mm-hmm. really the satiety, which is actually the brain that controls it. When you change where the nutrients of the food hit, so that's why they change how big the stomach is, and then they change the piping with a bypass. And so the nutrients hit in different spots. And with that, you get some of this GLP-1 difference and some of these other biological changes and satiety effect. But the GLP-1, these drugs have such a strong effect in the brain. I will say that I have patients that do the medicine first, then get surgery, sometimes don't need the GLP-1 anymore. Sometimes I have patients that do the surgery first, start regaining the weight, want the GLP-1. Some people that don't lose as much weight as they need to on the bariatric surgery, go on the GLP-1. And then vice versa, started GLP-1, did bariatric surgery, went back on it. And so honestly, I see them all as different tools, depending on the person. I have some people that haven't responded as well to the GLP-1. I strongly recommend bariatric surgery. Some of them still don't want to do it, but I have a couple others that are doing it now. And then they may continue the GLP-1 after. We don't know until they respond afterwards, but yeah. Definitely want to use all the tools. I do see though in the future, like where I'm like, I don't know, these things are getting so powerful where I think it's going to become less and less of a thing.
Wow. Which would be kind of amazing, right? To be able to use this along with lifestyle changes and not have to go under. I mean, that's pretty incredible. Now with it becoming so popular mainstream as well, not just, I mean, I'm not just seeing it within the obesity or diabetes populations anymore, especially with social media. There's lots of claims around what a GLP-1 is used for, who it's used for. So can we talk about like, what are the evidence-based claims in terms of GLP-1 aside from just weight loss? What is it? What are the other health benefits that are potentially we're seeing that a GLP-1 is helping with? And what are some of the myths that it's not?
Yeah. So obviously approved for type 2 diabetes, obviously approved for weight management. And then between there, they have some of these other indications like cardiovascular disease event reduction. So if you have type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, you're going to lower your risk of a heart attack. If you have obesity and a history of cardiovascular disease in semaglutide, at least, probably going to see it in tirzepatide. So tirzepatide's the Zepbound and Mounjaro. But right now with Wegovy, the higher dose of semaglutide, it cut your risk of having another heart attack if you've already have a history of heart disease. But pretty interesting stuff there. We're seeing it for sleep apnea, osteoarthritis. We're likely going to see an indication here soon. Liver disease due to your obesity. There's an indication as well there. Obviously, all these things are related to weight, but there are some what we call independent effects from the medicine that are likely having a benefit beyond or independent of the weight loss, which I think a lot of people think of as really interesting because it's like, oh, wow. Even if you don't lose a ton of weight, like for cardiovascular disease, you can cut your risk of having another heart attack. That's pretty cool. Yeah. That's a nice little benefit on top of just losing the weight. The weight loss likely has an effect there, but we think when they slice and dice the data, they think around 2/3 of it might be independent, meaning two-thirds of the effect of the weight loss isn't even from the weight. Of the cutting of the heart attacks isn't even from the weight loss, I should say.
Yeah, it's from the medicine, which is pretty incredible. And I've also seen some people who have had autoimmune issues go on a GLP-1 and report so many incredible benefits. Do we have the evidence behind that as well?
Yeah, so some of the stuff is preliminary, but here are the things that I think we're going to see it approved for. So there are multiple autoimmune diseases. There are top line results of Crohn's disease specifically with somebody with obesity. Again, this is anecdotal, but patients with psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, thinking of other autoimmune kind of conditions. I've never seen anything like it. They're like, wow, I'm on a biologic for my psoriatic arthritis, Skyrizi or one of these other biologic drugs that are out there. And it had a little bit of effect, but it wasn't until I started tirzepatide where I was like, whoa, within the first week, I could feel pain reduction. Even osteoarthritis, I posted about this. There's some interesting stuff in rodents where they're like, it looks like they're rebuilding some of their cartilage.
Wow.
Interesting stuff. And some people are like, well, is that because they've reduced how many calories that they're eating and it's having a metabolic effect there? There's a lot of debate there, but like I posted in my Facebook group for my patients and many of them were like, yeah, within the first week, my usual osteoarthritis of my knees, the pain was gone and I could work out easily. So that's why one thing I always tell people is like, don't think of these drugs as a shortcut. Think of these drugs as helping you do the things you already know you know how to do
Right.
They just, it just helps you do those things better, including exercise, because of the aches and pains and less joint pain and all that stuff, and maybe energy.
Wow.
It's interesting to me because whenever we talk about metabolics, you know, there's so many people that claim the root cause or one of the root causes of so many disorders, especially these chronically developed conditions, can be traced back to metabolics, specifically, you know, our insulin and sugar, you know, blood sugar response. So do you think that just by making us better able to handle glucose in our bloodstream, I know that there are a lot of anti-inflammatory effects, like, do you think that just becomes the thing that can help globally with so many of these issues? And kind of the follow-up question to that is, if it starts to become approved for all of these issues outside of weight loss, does there then start to become a concern that people who might not need to lose weight will have different side effects because they don't have weight to lose? And that might be something that comes along with taking the medicine?
Yeah. So the blood sugar regulation, so it's probably not specifically the blood sugar regulation that's helping. It's probably the metabolic milieu, such a stupid word, but like it's such a true thing. It's all the underlying like metabolic stress that the person is. It the adipose tissue. Obviously, there's an incretin effect that's been diminished in people with type 2 diabetes. But there's these drugs have a immunomodulatory effect, meaning the immune system is kind of what causes. You know, everybody talks about inflammation. It's an immune cell effect. Yeah. So these drugs help modulate and improve that effect to where we don't have as much metabolic stress going on. It's possible through that, and it could just be a bunch of separate mechanisms. How is it possible that one drug could have all these separate mechanisms? But it's possible that through that mechanism, it opens up all these other things. I don't know. I wish I could tell you exactly, because it's like, all right, how does this drug? So it works in the rewards. So alcohol use or even gambling and other drug addiction or addictive like behaviors, you know, obviously eating can be included in there. It has an effect on the brain for that. Okay, great. But then talking about cartilage rebuilding, it's like, really, it's building cartilage? Yeah. Or is this all from an effect? Is this kind of a domino effect from helping that underlying metabolic stress, which could be related to just precipitously dropping people's calories so quickly within a week? But I don't think so. There's GLP-1 receptors all over the body too. So it's a big debate. I would say the question about whether there is a worry about like leaner individuals using this. Yeah, there is, and this is where smaller, less potent or less therapeutic doses, people say microdosing may be what is needed here. Or what they need to do is have selective GLP-1 receptor agonists, which may work in one part of the body, but less may have less penetration into the brain. It starts getting a little bit crazy because they can change how these things hit various receptors, and you can make them potentially more selective. Because like let's say, for example, everybody wants to talk about the alcohol use disorder effect. I have a paper published. It's a retrospective study, but like it was clear. I was seeing it, right? It was tirzepatide specifically. So Mounjaro came out for type 2 diabetes, and a lot of us were using it off-label for weight management because it was like, holy cow, this stuff is the most powerful. It was already studied for weight management, wasn't approved yet for weight management. It came out, though, for type 2 diabetes approved, and we could get it. And the patients would say like, wow, I'm used to drinking a bottle of wine at night, and I just didn't feel like it anymore. And I just stopped. And I was like, what? So I'd go on TikTok and whatever, 2022, when this drug came out, and be like, hey, I'm seeing this. I've never seen anything like this. Anybody else seeing this? Boom, boom, viral. Because all of a sudden, everybody came out of the woodwork. We're seeing it. Articles come out. There was a randomized trial of semaglutide, which is the Ozempic and Wegovy drug, which showed that there's clearly an effect. I think tirzepatide specifically is a stronger effect. But if it's so powerful at helping people lose weight, let's say somebody does have alcohol use disorder, and they're a little bit thinner because they're malnourished, because they're not actually eating. So we see that. We see just somebody drinks a lot of alcohol doesn't mean that they have to have obesity and vice versa. So you can have thinner, you know, frailer, really at risk populations who drink mostly alcohol. They're very malnourished. So if you give them this drug, you got to be careful. Like, we don't want them to lose any more weight, but we want them to drink less alcohol and displace that alcohol with actually food. So yes, it is. It's absolutely a concern. I think it would require just lower doses. And, you know, like for me, example, I'm relatively lean, but I'm thinking about it like the lower doses from a metabolic standpoint. I haven't taken the drug, but I'm watching the cardiovascular disease reduction, a story kind of play out. I'm seeing the various metabolic effects in the joints and all sorts of things in the body. And I'm like, I just have a feeling that many of us are going to be honest, but we'd want to make sure that we're not losing too much weight, obviously, if we didn't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Because like, I think of someone like my mom who has osteoarthritis, and she's like, the inflammation moves in different joints, and, you know, and she works out all the time, but sometimes it's such a mental burden that she's feeling so much pain as she knows she has to work out, because it gets worse if she doesn't work out. But like, she's already so lean. Like, I would never want her on something like this, because she's already so lean. But like,
and she doesn't eat a lot.
But at the same time, I think it could be good, you know? So it's like, how could we get that to a point where it's like someone's not?
That's where the sci-fi so much situation that we are in, we are approaching sci-fi reality, where we can selectively create a GLP-1 agonist that only acts on addiction, or only acts on the cartilage inflammation in the joints.
And amazing.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, and the other thing that I'm seeing, and I kind of touched on this a little bit before we jumped on, was my mom groups. I mean, it kind of feels like it's becoming the new diet culture, in terms of skinny is back, and I have now a way that I can go almost anywhere and get on a GLP-1 and lose weight very quickly. I know women who, my husband sells it. So I go on for, you know, a few weeks before I need to be in a bikini and look snatched. And it's like, there's so many aesthetic purposes that people who are already lean are getting much leaner.
Yeah.
Is there risk in this? And is there like,
Look snatched. I'm just laughing. Is that a new phrase? Look snatched?
No. That might be probably old.
I mean, if you're like, can do like heavy snatches, you look.
I'm out of the loop.
I don't know. I just thought that was a new term. I was going with it, but okay. So this is a common question, because like the risk, first of all, you're going to still have the same types of risks that anybody where it's indicated would have is GI. It's usually GI side effects. So nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, reflux. Very rarely do we see some of these more severe risks, like gallstones and gallbladder attacks. Although that might be more so due to the weight loss. You get a change in your bile mixture when you're losing a lot of weight. And so that's what precipitates the stones, which then precipitates a potential gallbladder attack. And that can precipitate pancreatitis if it gets down into the wrong duct. But the general side effects are really like GI related. So if we go beyond that, what I really worry about are, it's the same as yo-yo dieting and weight cycling. So let's say you wanted to get into a bikini, or if you're a guy, you wanted to look good at something, whatever. And you do it for a month, you lose 10 pounds, you come off of it. Now, if you're weight training that whole time, I'm not worried about the body composition issues. But if you're not weight training all the time and you're doing this weight cycling thing, there's a worry that you're going to reduce your fat-free mass, which includes muscle and bone. And so I would worry about bone loss. I would probably worry about bone loss, and of course muscle loss. They go hand in hand. That would be the risk. I think it would be very similar to if you were just a yo-yo diet.
Knowing that, because the other thing that you hear a lot is that there's a significant amount of people that gain the weight back after coming off the medication. And, you know, I've listened to some, you talk a bit on this, but I'd love for you to explain, like, is this something that I'm going to need to take my whole life if I want to keep the weight off? Or are there ways to come off the medication? Or is it even necessary to come off the medication with all these other benefits we're talking about? Just like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, yeah. Most people, like if you're using it for weight management with an indicated purpose of like a history of overweight obesity, most people, probably around 90% or so of people, will have to continue taking it at some form or level of it. Doesn't mean you have to be in the max dose that you're on. Some people, I get onto teensy little doses that are like every other week or even once a month. Like, that's how low we can get with some of these people. But if they come off, they'll start gaining. You put them on just a teeny bit and they'll keep their weight off. But then there are some people that can come off. The idea is that these drugs are just obesity, overweight, chronic disease, same kind of thing as any other chronic disease we have. So you want to do chronic therapy for that. And people forget that like diet and exercise are a chronic therapy. So if you lose weight doing diet and exercise, you got to keep doing those things. Mm-hmm. So, but if you need the medicine, you just need to have the medicine similar. And like you said before, are there benefits? Like, yeah, it's possible. In fact, actually likely that if you take two people who have the same person, history of cardiovascular disease and obesity, and one person loses weight without that drug, the other person loses weight with the drug, the person that loses the weight with the drug probably has more benefit than the person that didn't. That's the thing that I think really is like, oh God, really? So there's not like any, you don't get any award or reward for doing it without the medicine other than like you can pretend you're better than everybody because you did it without them. That's what people think. They have like this badge of honor. And it's okay. I understand the concept of it. It's just, I don't want people to think that way because I don't want them to feel shame if they take the drug. So yeah, you can come off of it. It's not very many people that can. Most people regain the weight. The reason is because the drug is really pushing back against your appetite centers in the brain. And when you remove it, appetite comes back. And people think of appetite and be like, it's just a willpower thing, but that's the biology of it. It's not just hunger and satiety. It's also cravings. And then what most people are talking about is food noise, which is really thinking constantly about food. And that's, I really think that's the very powerful thing about the drugs, because I can give you other medicine and bariatric surgery to make you not as hungry. But if you're still thinking about food, that it's lingering there. And if you're just still constantly thinking about it, you're not hungry, you can still eat despite not being hungry. And that's where the drugs just, they just wipe it out of the system.
It's not an unfounded thought that people have that like, oh, I can't be on this medicine for life. Because I think it just comes from understanding the history of downstream effects of being on a medication for 2, 3, 4 decades, you know, and historically there tends to be a lot more side effects or physiologic drift that we see that is not as positive. And it's even hard for me to understand like, oh, it could just be beneficial to take a low dose of this medication for life, with minimal to no long-term side effects.
A lot of people are waiting for some smoking gun because it's like, holy cow, how is it possible that these drugs are so good? But so far, so good. It's like, I don't know. It seems to be.
I know. And is there any risk? Because now it is so widely available. People can go to, I don't even know where people are getting it, but they're getting it very, very easily.
Very easily, very inexpensively.
There's no testing that needs to be done. There's no, you know, so is that a risk factor as well, where people are getting it from? And the fact that there's no testing being done, should there be tests being done? Should we be doing follow-up? Like, what does that all look like?
Yeah. So I only recommend the FDA approved versions. With the shortages, the compounded versions came out. And that's why there's a law that like even if they're a patented drug, compounders can come out with an exact copy, because it makes it so like during shortages, hey, we can find other versions here. The problem is there are a lot of bad players out there, and we just can't attest to what is actually in it. So there's compounding is one level. But then there's the whole gray market, or maybe as some people call it, just the straight up the black market, where there's getting the active pharmaceutical ingredient from China. Mm-hmm. And like unless you're testing every single batch all the time with all the rigorous, and there's so many different types of tests and people don't even understand it, like to know exactly what's in there, the purity, make sure all the different things are safe about it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go that route. But like you said, you could get anywhere. You can go to your hair salon and it could be selling it out. I mean, like, you can go online and get this stuff, and they're research peptides, and people are doing it. I wouldn't recommend it. You are hearing horror stories. Sometimes it's straight up legit stuff and pure, and people know because they're doing great on it. And then other times they're getting, I had one patient that had arsenic poisoning. Oh my God, this is scary stuff. But then you'll see on Reddit, you know, people are like, I've done fine and I'm doing the best I ever had with this, the cheap stuff they got from whatever peptide site. And I just, you know, me personally, I'm not going to take the liability of recommending, because, like, at the off chance that you got a bad batch, because one of these compounding places that was really big, they had glass in their vials. They didn't even, like, there were people who were injecting glass, like little tiny shards. So, and that doesn't mean that the FDA approved version, sometimes they have issues, but they're regularly monitoring and they will get dinged hard. They're monitoring those much more rigorously. So it doesn't make them perfect, but that's where I would only get it from. But so I would worry. I understand the cost is an issue because the FDA approved versions are more expensive. They are getting cheaper though. And I think the demand, and there's lots of government stuff going on that I hope the prices just keep coming down. Capitalism, I think, will win in this. I think there's what's called a duopoly. There's only two companies, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. Novo Nordisk was like the big one, Ozempic and Wegovy. They're kind of the original folks. And Eli Lilly came in with their Zepbound and Mounjaro and really kind of stormed the whole place with them. And so they kind of control the market. There are going to be some other players jumping in. And I think what we're going to see is the prices will just, over the next 5 to 10 years, be very affordable for most people. Right now, it's kind of like, either insurance covers it, or you kind of have to be, I wouldn't say wealthy, but you have to, you got to have some money to buy them.
I know. And that was going to be one of my questions too. Like, do you just see the health gap between those who can afford it and those who can't, like, continue to escalate, which is kind of sad.
It is sad. Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunate. But that's where I do think in the next years, it's just going to keep coming down to where more and more people afford it. It's kind of like anything with technology, you know, like, let's say like TVs, like those big screen TVs. I don't know how old you guys are, but I remember when I was young, like the only people that had huge screen TVs when I was like in elementary school were like rich people. And I would be like, Jesus. And they, of course they were crappy back then, but they were still huge.
Yeah.
And now, like, you don't have to be rich. They're cheap. You get a big old screen TV, is like not that hard to do. I think we're going to see the same thing with the drugs. Rich people, and you know, there's people that some Medicaids like are covering it actually, but it's not, that's not the usual.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to start seeing it covered much more. It's really bad, right? It's getting better, and it was really bad even before. Getting slowly better, and it's going to be a lot better in the next 5 years, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Hopefully the research continues to pile up in a way that insurance companies can't ignore, and they start to cover more of these for the general population. And competition's always good, especially in pharma, when we can have multiple players putting these medicines out there.
Yep.
What about a question I would have is for the things that always seem to be the ultimate contraindications, pregnancy and cancer. You know, I've seen people putting stuff out there on GLP-1 use, either trying to get pregnant while pregnant.
Yeah. I just had a reproductive endocrinologist on, and cause I was like trying to pin her down. I'm like, look, these drugs are really good for fertility. I think we're going to see them approved maybe for fertility purposes, at least in PCOS.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
I've never seen anything like it. All of a sudden, hadn't had periods in a year, or years, and all of a sudden, boom, normal cycles within a week or so. They feel like they haven't even adjusted their eating, and they'd lost weight before, and their P periods didn't come back. There's something about the drug that is going on. Anyway, I don't even remember the question. What was
Well, I've had someone pregnancy. Ask, you know, for fertility reasons, they were on a GLP-1, right? And do they continue it through pregnancy? Yes, and then what about nursing?
Okay, so
and
major contraindication. That's right. Okay, so major contraindication. So pregnancy, yes. The reason is it's simply an ethical thing to looking at, trying to do studies in pregnant women, you know, like,
yeah.
Hey, let's see what happens to the baby. Like, let's give you a placebo on this. So a lot of times what we see with these studies is people are just so happen to be on them. And so they do these observational trials where they don't do an experiment where they put somebody on placebo versus the active drug. They look back at kind of what happened. And then more and more data come out and people have been on these drugs and getting pregnant all the time. I have tons of patients that have been on them. The guidance is to stop at 2 months prior to trying to conceive. Mm. But because they're so powerful at conception, people are even on birth control or they just weren't even thinking about it. They get pregnant all the time on the medicine. And that's where the retrospective, the studies come out and go, well, at least let's look at what happened here. Yeah. And so far, it looks like pretty safe. There were some concerns in animals where maybe you're worried about restricted growth in the babies. But like in humans, it looks like things are fine. The worry is that if you take it during pregnancy and try to lose weight, right. Obviously that's not going to be good. The babies still need their nutrients. So we tell everybody to stop it. It's like, please don't take this. And we don't use any other weight loss medicines during non-GLP-1 during pregnancy either. But think about Zofran, anti-nausea medicine. That used to be like, no, don't use that during pregnancy. And I don't know, there's some new data. When I was in residency, I did family medicine originally. And I hated OB like because I felt like I was going to pull the baby's head off every time I was delivering. But I had to do it because it was part of my residency. And you know, they were going over some of the studies during, you know, a journal club and how Zofran, like, oh, it looks like, and they the same thing. They didn't do an experiment in it, but they looked back, it looked like people are using Zofran. They did fine. Anyway, just an aside. So we don't want people to do it. Now, I think what's going to happen, the further we're going to get, we're going to see higher risk pregnant women, like say type 2 diabetes, who are now really bad blood sugar control, mm-hmm. and they're gaining a ton of weight. I think it's not out of the realm that we're going to see them continue, just like metformin. Metformin is continued during pregnancy. The other risk, I mean, this data just came out a month or so ago, that if you get pregnant and you stop the medicine, those people gain a lot more weight during pregnancy than somebody who gets pregnant without having the medicine. And the reason is obviously when you remove the medicine, your appetite goes up. You're obviously gaining weight during pregnancy and you're going to gain much more. So I think it's possible that at some point they're going to start removing some of those very exclusions on the label. It's not anytime soon. And there's probably some doctors out there who are messing around with it. From a liability standpoint, I'm like, I'm not messing around with that. But I could see it happening.
I think my favorite part of the podcast, I'm going to call it the what Dr. Spencer thinks. Because after all your answers, you say what I think is going to happen.
Yeah,
I love those takes because it only makes sense once the data becomes robust enough where we have enough of that retrospective observational data on a scale large enough to say, like, we're not seeing any difference in the people that say they're on the medicine and say they aren't. Like, why not reduce the risk of that person who suddenly gains 100 pounds and now they're at risk of, you know,
exactly
hypertension, uncontrolled, you know, gestational diabetes, all those types of things. Yeah,
exactly. That's what I think. I'm not going to make the call right now, but that's what I believe will happen.
And I've heard it being used for cancer as well, especially if people are obese and overweight and on and currently doing cancer treatment. For those who've had cancer in the past, is it something that is safe for someone to take? Like, is there any risk that we're seeing with this?
Yeah, there are only a few concerns. Somebody with a history of pancreatic cancer. The drugs haven't been shown to have any difference from a placebo in terms of causing pancreatic cancer. I had a patient recently who had a history of pancreatic cancer, and none of their doctors wanted to put them on it. To me, it doesn't even make biological sense. Because I don't think it would cause it. But because their other doctors didn't want to do it, I'm like, well, I'm not going to be the one to tell you. Because yeah. Just out of the pure chance
right.
that they develop a recurrence, and all of a sudden they're like, well, this Dr. Spencer guy, he makes a lot of memes, and he said I should go on. I'd be like, oh my God, I shouldn't have done that. It's a liability thing, but I actually think that would be fine. So I'm trying to think of any the only one cancer is actually, it's medullary thyroid cancer. And the reason is... that's the one cancer they saw in rats. Now, rats have, it's a big black box warning on the label. People with a family history of medullary thyroid cancer, do not take this drug or in a personal history of it. Rats have GLP-1 receptors on their special cells that make this rare thyroid cancer. And so they saw it in rodents. Humans, I don't know. But again, I'm not going to be the one to break that. So that's the one cancer, but other things. So many cancers are driven by adipose tissue, just because of the hormones that you release from it. Estrogen being one of them. So breast cancer, any weight related or fat adipose related cancers. It looks like there's a signal for reducing those. In other things, it doesn't look like there's a signal for increasing cancer so much. The big thing they were worried about was thyroid and pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancer doesn't seem to be an issue. The one is the medullary thyroid cancer, although lots of arguments still mm-hmm. there that they should probably remove that warning on the label. But yeah, I have a ton of patients with a history of breast cancer, no problem continuing it. If they're undergoing cancer treatment, we do want to worry about potential undernourishment, mm-hmm. of course, mm-hmm. so during yeah. chemotherapy, but
yeah.
might be reasonable to have very low doses. I always just work with their oncologist if that's yeah. the case.
I mean, that all makes sense. Now, I can't leave without also asking, because there's different forms of GLP-1s that yeah. seem to be available now as well. And I know I've seen you talk about some of the sublingual, so some of the drops
oh, yeah.
that are now coming out. And there's also oral version. So how yeah. are these comparing to the injections? Is there going to be an oral version that is going to be just as good?
Yeah. So you inject the stuff is because the peptide is delicate. It goes, if it gets with our stomach acid, it degrades, the peptide degrades, and then you won't absorb it. So there is one current, there's going to be another one, but there is one current oral version. It was first Rybelsus, which was for type 2 diabetes. It's semaglutide. It's the same stuff that's in Ozempic and Wegovy. But they put this special technology encapsulated with that changes the pH or buffers the acid in your stomach in an area to where you still have to put a ton of it in the capsule or in the tablet to be able to absorb it, but then you still get some in there, and it allows you to actually get some into your system. So Rybelsus, and now they have oral. It just came out a month or so ago, oral Wegovy. They really crank up the dose in there and put the special technology. So that's the one thing that's effective. There is a newer one, probably we're a month or so away from it being approved, called, and by the time this podcast is out, it might be approved, called Orforglipron. And I don't know what the trade name they're going to come out with. We'll see. It's going to be interesting what they call it. But that one's what's called a small molecule. Instead of a peptide, it's a small molecule. And that one can be absorbed, no problem, through the GI tract. It's mm-hmm. okay. It's not amazing at weight loss. 11 or so percent total body weight loss. The oral Wegovy or semaglutide gets close to the injectable. It's around 14 or so. 14 to 15% total body weight loss. I think in the future, so what we're seeing now, those are just purely GLP-1 receptor agonists. So that's semaglutide and then this orforglipron. Tirzepatide, though, is a GLP-1/GIP. There are two incretins in one. And GIP is actually the first incretin that was discovered. There are a lot of technical reasons of why they didn't go that route at first. And they only went the GLP-1 route, but tirzepatide hits two different receptors in the body. And that's part of the reason why they think it works better, both for Obviously for blood sugar regulation, but for appetite control and maybe other metabolic effects. In the future, there's multiple receptors that they're starting to change these peptides and molecules. So in the future, there are going to be other oral versions that that will hit multiple receptors and be very, very powerful. Mm. So these are in phase two, though, maybe some phase three, but we're 5 or so years from some of these really powerful oral versions, but really powerful injectable versions were about a year away. Wow. Probably people have heard of retatrutide, mm-hmm. Which hits GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon. And so not only does that help with appetite suppression, but it also revs up our metabolic rate a little bit. A very powerful, that's going to get somewhere around 30% total body weight loss. That's like a big shotgun for some people that don't need as much weight loss. So we're still going to probably use those other drugs first, but I'm going to use that retatrutide in my patients that were on tirzepatide and still have another 50 or so pounds to lose.
Right.
And then multiple other type of receptors. I mean, the future is just, it's kind of crazy looking what's coming down the pipeline. They have to do these studies though, because you never know what offshoot effects. It's possible one of these other receptors, like, oh God, we didn't know that. That actually did cause cancer. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, that one actually increased cardiovascular events. Has to be studied. That's why when you're going to see some of these drugs in the pipeline come, they're available in the gray market. Recommend not to do that, because even if you're getting the pure stuff, we don't know if it's safe yet. So that's the, you'll see these GLP-1 drops and sublingual. None of those things have been proven to actually work. There's no data to support. You can actually put these special compounded drops under your tongue or pills under your tongue. So the only ones that work are the FDA approved versions. And then supplements that claim to be natural GLP-1 or natural GLP-1 activators. As I mentioned before, even if you boosted your own GLP-1 by 2 or 3 times, which is what those DPP-4 drugs do, you don't lose any weight with those drugs. You have blood sugar improvements. So people that are promoting GLP-1 supplements, you may have some benefits in terms of blood sugar regulation, but you're not going to have a weight loss benefit. So I would recommend not using those.
Yeah.
Just a lot of people out there trying to take advantage of the, craze.
Of course. Yes.
That all the GLP-1 questions, and would you have one more minute for, been something eating at my mind that's unrelated that I just want to end with your quick soapbox opinion on, because it got brought up at the beginning how so many people like to compare health and obesity, especially in the United States versus, say, other developed European countries. And I just want to give you the mic for a second to say, like, why? Why do we see such health differences between, you know, some of these other developed countries in Europe when, you know, people on social media like to say, oh, if we just did this one thing like European countries did, we'd be so much healthier?
Yeah, there's probably a social determinants of health type of thing. If I know, Jen, you're familiar with this, and there's clearly cultural differences. They have universal health care and different public health over in the different countries, that completely different cultural differences too. I'll never forget when I went to Paris with my wife like 10 years ago, and we went out to the restaurant. Everybody, the other people were laughing and just there for hours. She and I just blah, 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 ate our food really fast. And we looked around and be like, oh my gosh, we're the stupid Americans that everybody calls those stupid Americans. You know? And I'm like, so just, and you know, I don't struggle with my weight, but it's like, little things like that, all those things add up. And so like, yeah, when I say it's biological, but it's also environmental, everything from birth can also have changes in our metabolic programming of what we do later in life. So really, I think that's gotta be the big reason there.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to end on a little population health note and all the things that are done in different countries to help provide the environment around people to make the decisions and encourage and promote the decisions that might be better for our health that we might not have as safety nets here in the United States. So,
yeah. But where can people go learn more about you, work with you, especially if they're interested in safely going about this route of obtaining GLP-1s.
Yeah. So my Instagram is Dr. Nadolsky. I'm on TikTok too. I don't actually go on TikTok. My videos post over there, and some of them are not eligible for recommendation. I don't know why. So forget about TikTok, but Instagram, Facebook's also there. I have a YouTube channel you can look up. I have my podcast called Docs Who Lift. And then if you want to work with me or my other doctors, join vineyard.com. It's, I called it Vineyard. It's a whole thing of why I called it Vineyard, but that's where we're kind of GLP-1 specialists, but we do much beyond GLP-1. You get your own dietitian, you get your own doctor, and you get a weight training program. And we try to give you everything you need for your weight and complete metabolic health. We'll do your blood pressure, cholesterol. We even do, if we need to do sleep studies for sleep apnea. We even do tretinoin for your face and wrinkles and minoxidil for your hair if you need it. And thyroid, wow, and menopausal hormonal. We do it all, but we focus on the GLP-1s because that's our specialty.
Wow, that sounds amazing to be able to really take a whole look at the body in terms of what someone goal needs. That's amazing. Well, Dr. Spencer, we appreciate you so much for taking the time and answering all of my questions that I had. I think what you're doing and the knowledge that you're getting out is helping so many people not be afraid of science and medications and what is actually beneficial and how it can help people. So thank you for the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for sticking around for another interview. We were so excited to finally get Dr. Nadolsky on the podcast. He is an absolute wealth of information. So please, if this is a topic of interest to you or someone you might know, give him a follow on social, pass his socials on, and check out his website because he is a trusted resource in this area. And remember, we are starting our Lifting for Longevity course. It is a brand new course that Jen shot with her mom, who's 73 years old, to show that regardless of the stage or age you are at in life and the restrictions that you have, you can train strength, power, and all the aspects of longevity in movement that you need to be able to move well even later in life. The course is still on discount right now, and we're all starting on Monday, March 30th, together to move through this program. And as a podcast listener, you can get a special extra discount using code OPTIMAL at checkout. And of course, we will see you on the next episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.